Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Tim Miller and I are both sufficiently caffeinated to go into the long holiday weekend. So first of all, good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Charlie.
So it turns out that both you and I are getting on airplanes later today, which means that I can bounce off this dilemma I have with you that if I have to wear a mask most of today, do I have to bother shaving?
I don't think you have to bother shaving today. No, I don't know what you have planned when you land. I don't know if you've got like a dinner jacket party or anything like that. So I don't think you do. And I get my dilemma is like, I guess if I'm going to have to suffer through a mask, I have a very short little puddle hopper. I'm going to south to LA to see the LSU Tigers in the Rose Bowl for the first time in history. I guess you do the N95, right? I mean, we read the studies, we saw the studies, and I guess if I have to suffer, you just do it right.
No, I think so, at least. So you're in the mood for... Right before the podcast, you named it Cold Joe Fall.
I said I'm not letting Cold Joe Fall affect my plans.
Okay, but we've gone from Hot Joe Summer to Cold Joe Fall. Like, I don't want to pile on, but you make a list of things that have happened to the president this week. Afghanistan, the pandemic, you have fires, you have floods. Joe Manchin says that we should have a strategic pause on the $3.5 trillion bill, which could torpedo it. You got these relatively crappy job numbers, massive miss in job creation. And then you have, the polls showing that he's underwater. So yeah, it seems like a long time ago that we were all giddy and, Hot Joe Summer and economy was coming
only
back.
A couple weeks. And I'm like so that. Happy I didn't write this. I was thinking about it. I had a mental take prepared. It wasn't quite ready yet. I knew it wasn't quite warm, and I didn't want to say it because I didn't want to jinx anything. Seems like the jinx was not relevant in this instance. But I was like, everything has been hitting for him up through July. And I was like, I can't remember the last time the president had such a smooth year. Presidents don't get smooth years anymore. Maybe they never did. I don't know. But I guess Bill Clinton kind of did, before he got in some trouble in the 90s. Were there some smooth years in the 90s?
I don't remember. In the early 90s? Everything in the 90s, even the impeachment, seems calm and normal compared to now.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's memory can fool you.
Yeah, you just don't get this. You just don't get it. And there's just so much that's out of your hands. Obviously, I think some of these mistakes have been in his hands. Some of them have been out. He's going to go through a little rocky period here. It's an okay time for it. A year and plus out from the midterms rather than right before the midterms. And I think that there's time to steady the ship. I was on Beg to Differ yesterday, the Mona Charon podcast that everybody should listen to for more serious talk than sometimes we offer here on the flagship.
I'm offended,
and I said this is happening with everyone, right? I mean Biden has some unique problems. Some of the Republican governors have had some unique problems, which I'm sure we'll get into. But if you look at Morning Consult, had a poll out yesterday that covered the favorability ratings of all the guys. Everybody's going down, basically, except for a handful of popular rhinos up in the Northeast, like our friend Phil Scott and Charlie Baker. But pretty much everybody else's popularity is going down. People are not happy with Delta. Obviously, we've had the climate issues that you've brought up, and we can talk about it more length. And Afghanistan, and it's the news environment is rocky for the president. There's no doubt.
Yeah, it is. So I'm just looking at the Chris Cillizan newsletter from yesterday. He had his newsletter was the poll number will send Democrats into a panic. Now maybe this doesn't factor in what's happening with the abortion issue because I think that's going to be a big deal. So this is the new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll. Biden's approval rating is down to 43%, a drop of 6 points in a single month, which is bad. But this is what he focused on. 41% of people say they strongly disapprove of the job Biden is doing, while just 19% strongly approve of how he's handling his job. So that would suggest there's kind of this passion gap. I mean, the good news is the Democrats are not a cult of personality. The bad news is the Republicans are, and they will still crawl through, you know, glass and fire, et cetera, to vote for the Orange God King. But people are rather tepid right now on
I hope and for all that we've eliminated, there was this kind of popular theory on particularly left-wing Twitter for a while in the late 2010s. It was like, you know, persuading people doesn't matter anymore. It's all about matching the Republicans' enthusiasm gap. It's like, you're never going to match the enthusiasm gap of a cult. And there is actually a pretty sizable chunk of people that need to be persuaded for the Democrats to get to, the numbers that they need, especially because of the structural disadvantage they have in the Electoral College and the Senate. Like the Democrats need to persuade people that are not on board with the, you know, full AOC agenda. There was some doubt that those people existed for some reason, which was always silly. But just the look at Biden's, you can just see it in Biden's favorability numbers. I think that some of these people are folks that disapprove of his policy decisions, disapprove of his handling of Afghanistan. I think sometimes with favorability, some of this is just mood of the country, right? People just use it as a stand-in for, ugh, the coronavirus is back, et cetera. But I think it makes the case for, you know, the Matt Iglesias, David Shore popularism argument in the Democratic Party that it is incumbent upon them to focus on doing popular things and being popular in a way that it's not incumbent on Republicans because of the cult, and that might be unfair, but it's reality.
Yeah, what a radical idea that they should do popular things.
Very controversial.
It's funny. Matt Lewis actually has an interesting column in the Daily Beast today. You know, why is nobody trying to seduce the Never Trumpers? It seems like, look, you look at the numbers, and Never Trump voters, you know, appear to have made a difference in states like Wisconsin. And, you know, that whole Ron Johnson thing, admitting that Trump lost, is basically his argument is, look, if all the Republicans who voted in down ballot races had voted for Trump, he would have won the state, but he didn't. He lost about, you know, 50,000 votes of people who voted for other Republicans, but didn't vote for Trump. So, hey, you know, who knows? Never Trumpers turn out to be relevant. And yet it's interesting. There's nothing in the Republican Party, or frankly, in a lot of the rhetoric of the Democrats, that suggests that we're on anybody's radar screen right now, you know.
Matt, I didn't realize Matt Lewis was so needy. I guess he needs chocolates and some roses and, you know, work me over. He's correct in the assessment of the politics, right? I mean, I think that your point, the Ron Johnson video was so telling, and I loved our friend Sarah Longwell's tweet about that, which was like, man, I think if you summarize this viral video of Ron Johnson explaining why the Republicans lost in 2020, he's essentially saying it was the Republican voters against Trump that did it. And he's right in that as kooky as Ron Johnson can be, he can still look at numbers when he's being forthright. And it was voters that voted for Republicans down ballot and Joe Biden that helped push him over the edge in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Georgia, probably in Arizona too, for that matter. And it is a relevant demo. The problem is that, you know, if you're Republicans right now, you're looking at juicing that enthusiasm gap that you just talked about. And you don't do that by, you know, talking to us about norms and comity and all the things that we care about. And if you're the Democrats, I think that Biden is, you know, worried about shoring up his base. I think that there's a little bit more of a strategic question about whether that's the right move or not. But I think that they're feeling a lot of pressure from the left flank, pressure, you know, they have the trifecta, they have the House and the Senate and the president, they need to get things done. If they don't do it, if they don't appease the left, then they're going to have enthusiasm gap next year. And that kind of just, you know, leaves us homeless again and lonely with, nobody calling us, nobody texting, you know, nobody.
See, I made my peace with that you know, other people were more enthusiastic about, you know, talking about Red Dog Democrats or the Biden Democrats. And I'm like, hey, no, I like being on an island. I'm antisocial. I've been in my basement here for the last year and a half with nobody talking to me, and I'm okay with this. This is fine.
Well, I'm glad that you're secure in yourself and don't need to be buttered up to the degree that Matt Lewis does. I know, you know, some people Simon are more needy than you. Some people are more needy, Charlie. But I will say,
play the Simon Garfunkel song. You know. I am a rock. I am, you know, what?
Boy, these 60s references. This, if it makes you feel bad, my Not My Party yesterday was a reference to a 1998 movie, and I started doing the math in my head, and I was like, literally 56% of the audience was not born when this 1998 movie, when Rounders came out. Excellent movie. Better than the Simon Garfunkel song, if we're going to make oldies references.
No.
But okay. I'll say this about the Red Dogs, just really quick.
It's wrong.
Strategically speaking,
deeply wrong.
The Democrats need Charlie, right? And so I think that there are versions of Charlie Sykes out there. People don't act like this character doesn't exist. It does exist. It is not enough to have any influence in either party, but it is enough to swing elections. And you know, this bizarro Charlie does not follow politics as closely as you do.
Right.
Right. And they didn't like Donald Trump at all. But they're, you know, still conservative. I won't say what age bracket they're in. You know, they live in the suburbs or the exurbs of a city like Milwaukee. Maybe it's Detroit. Yeah, they're spry. They're spry. They're in the Detroit exurbs. And yeah, if things are going poorly, if the virus looks like it's coming back, and Afghanistan looks like it's a shit show, and you know, they don't feel like their economic prospects are improving as much as they thought, like, that person is likely to just go back to the other team, and that is an important part right now of the Democrats' coalition, because they lost the working class union guys. You can't lose the working class union guys and not gain back this suburban, exurban Charlie Sykes. That is a recipe for a big Republican majority in the House, and, you know, a 4 or 5 seat Republican majority in the Senate. You got to go one of those paths, and so it's an important group for the Democrats to eventually court.
Okay, so let's do a little bit of a lightning round here.
Okay.
Unfair questions early in the morning.
Great.
So the biggest threat to Joe Biden and the Democrats right now is blank.
I think it's a perception of incompetence. I don't think that it's any one thing. I think it's an overall perception that he's lost the rope.
Okay.
I'm not saying that I think that he's lost the rope or anything like that. I just think that if you combine the virus and Afghanistan and kind of the messaging of Republicans, biggest concern.
Okay.
He's got to steady the ship.
I would agree with that the biggest threat to Biden and the Democrats right now is this sense of lack of competence. Look, I think there's all kinds of challenges out there, including rising crime, including the border, including the what happened in Afghanistan, the impression of weakness. Inflation is going to be a very significant issue. All of these things, the mood of the country is a threat. But you know what I wrote down? My answer was the biggest threat to Joe Biden right now is the progressive echo chamber that won't let them know what the biggest threats are. that will talk about other things, or that will get their hair on fire about things that actually do not speak to the voters that you were just describing so eloquently a moment ago. Because the reality is that sometimes, you know, you and I are both contributed to a certain, you know, cable station. Turn on every once in a while and I go, okay, do you actually listen to yourself? Do you know how this is actually going to play anywhere else? Because, you know, there is a strain of thought that says that right now that the response to everything that's happening is let's go as far left as aggressively as possible. Let's just do all this again. Well, no, not necessarily. That may not be what works for you. So, okay, that was
a question. I want to respond to that, because I agree as a political matter that is a threat that the Democrats face, and I think that they could benefit from some self-reflection. I want to explain this. I saw a tweet the other day. I'm trying to pull it up really quick. Okay, here it is. It's from my old friend Jon Favreau. He wrote, here's the GOP platform for 2022. Bounties on abortions, harass and disenfranchise Dem voters, fire educators who teach kids about racism, prevent schools from stopping COVID spread, threaten businesses to comply with a domestic terrorism investigation. And I looked at that tweet and I was like, yeah, he's right. The Republicans are fucking insane.
Yeah.
They're batshit insane. But here's the problem is that a lot of that stuff is kind of ephemeral. You know how we talked during the Trump era that this was really, it was one of the most frustrating things for me when Trump was around, is that all the stuff that made me that made my hair on fire the most about him was the way he treated, the way he went around doing his business, and just like the notion of having this corrupt, venal, bigoted piece of crap in the West Wing. Like, that's what bugged me the most. There's a pack of voters out there that just don't care about that stuff that much, right? And that for Trump to lose, he needed to fuck something up that affected them personally.
Right,
the virus was finally that, right? And so right now, maybe this can be abortion, which we'll talk about in a second.
Yes.
But right now, when you look at this stuff like the January 6th and like the rhetoric around critical race theory and the rhetoric around refugees and all of the stuff that we can rant and rave about, it is all noxious. It is all terrible, but it's not impacting people's lives day to day. Right. And so I think this is part of the problem, is that some of it is ideological in the progressive echo chamber. And some of it is just like, how can you not look at these guys and think that they're batshit and insane and how can you vote for them? And
which we understand
is creating these blinders.
Which we can sympathize with.
Totally.
So give me an opinion that you have that you hold very strongly, but you're nervous to express publicly.
This right now, it's funny.
No. Just between you and me.
Yeah, just between you and me. We're gonna cut this part.
Well, no,
my weekend newsletter might be about this. I have about half written, and I haven't decided. It's tough to. I got just slammed for a very soft anti-abortion comment on Twitter yesterday or 2 days ago, and I do think that sometimes our new friends. It's easy to have lip service and say, you know, I just appreciate the fact that we're all aligned in defending democracy and that we all care about the big enemy, you know, Donald Trump the most. And I'm so appreciative that they switch teams, and I love the Never Trumpers. That's like a nice thing to say, right?
And we're looking forward to getting back to debating other issues.
Yeah. Right? I look forward to getting back to debating other issues.
Well, fuck that.
Then when the other issues come up, it's kind of like, whoa, like this guy's insane. So, I think that you wrote in your newsletter today about abortion, and I think you did a really nice job going through the polling, and I'd encourage people to just look at it because I don't have it off the top of my head. Like, the mainstream of the country is kind of where I am on abortion, and yet I am not, I'm anathema to both the Republican Party position on it and the Democratic elite position. I think that I'm pretty well in line with what a lot of rank and file Democrats who are just completely absent from cable news. You know, I mean, they're just silenced from cable news. But
there's a huge middle. There is.
Yeah. Actually. This notion that obviously, you know, rape, incest, life of the mother, you know, or early term abortions, when there's fetal abnormalities, like all these sorts of things. But like, that doesn't mean that, you know, there should just be abortion on demand, unrestricted abortion, late term abortion, all this sorts of stuff. Like, that is the mainstream opinion of the country. I might write a little bit more about what kind of undergirds my view about that this weekend. I don't know. It might be for next weekend if I don't feel like I do a very good job, so y'all can hold me accountable. It's tough to talk about.
It is, no doubt.
And pretending like it's not, I mean, you know, because the replies I got from the people that disagree, it's not just like, Tim, I respectfully disagree with your opinion on late-term abortion. It's much meaner than that.
Yeah, you're a man. You shouldn't have an opinion about all of this. No, the polling has always been fascinating to me because you do have like about 60% of Americans who favor abortion rights, sort of in the abstract, don't want to see Roe overturned. That's been kind of consistent, but when you get down into the other numbers, you know, you have about 31% who believe that abortion should always be legal, the absolutist pro-choice position. Only 8% of Americans think it should be illegal without any exceptions. And this is interesting because the Texas bill allows no exceptions for rape or incest. So this is a bill supported by nationally 8% of voters. And yet these extremes are the ones that now dominate the debate. And if you try to have any sort of a nuanced opinion, you get absolutely slammed. So by the way, that was a pretty good answer to what you're nervous about. Here's what I'm nervous about.
Okay.
Saying, and I was going to say somebody's name, but I'm not going to do it. But, you know, some of the, I am torn with thinking that people should really be taking everything happening very, very seriously. But the hysterical, you know, they shot Johnny and I'm going to run into the machine guns rhetoric is getting a little bit much. But the more specific point is, I do think that democracy faces an existential threat. And I think Democrats are completely missing the point. I think that when they go to, they dial up the outrage meter to 12 on the Texas bill that says, for example, we can't have, voting at 3 a.m. or drive-through voting and everything. Okay, you can make a case why that's a good thing as opposed to a bad thing. That is not the end of democracy as we know it. What is the end of democracy as we know it is the possibility that Republicans will convince themselves that they can use their legislative majorities to overturn the popular vote in the Electoral College. And so while there's all of this heavy breathing about these restrictions, about drop boxes and everything, fine. It's a much bigger problem about who counts the votes and what that environment's going to be. And so, you know, again, you have all of this, you know, big breastfeeding about some of the details in the Texas bill, which I'm not defending and I'm not saying is, you know, shouldn't be opposed. But that is not Jim Crow times 10. That is not the greatest threat to democracy. It's something else involving the way electoral votes are counted. And I just don't see any Democrat coming to grips with it. And the other thing that I'm a little bit nervous about writing is a column that I actually have in front of me with the title, Democrats, you had one job, not to fuck it up. And then it goes on.
Yeah, we're just going to go ahead and tank the bulwark here this week. I'm going to talk about my hardline anti-abortion stance, and you can talk about the Democrats not fucking it up. And, you know, it's been fun. It's been a great, like, year or 2 years, however long it's been. Great downloads and... You know, okay, let's just go for it. Let's talk about your publish the same day.
Okay, so you're not your party. I wrote about it this week. You wrote about it, This is not a matter of Schadenfreude. I want to make it people very, very clear that no one's taking any pleasure in this, but it's an extraordinary phenomenon. And I wrote about it, and you talked about it, and people ought to watch the video. All of these anti-vax talk show hosts who have been railing against vaccines and masks and sneering about Anthony Fauci and about the CDC, and then get COVID and then die of COVID. I mean, it's like I'm sorry, it's like COVID karma working overtime, and these are terrible, terrible tragedies. But it is an amazing story, and it makes you wonder really what's going on. And I mean,
yeah,
you kind of know what you're doing.
Yeah, I was texting with producer Drew about how I wanted to do this topic on Sunday night, and then your newsletter popped Monday morning, and I was like, "Great, Charlie did half the work for us. He's already done all the research." It's important because I think that it is telling of an underlying thing that has political resonance, I think, for Democrats, which is that the entire program that J.D. Vance, Josh Mandel style populists are offering Republicans is phony. Like it's phony. It's nonsense. Like they're being suckered, and they don't actually care about anyone. And I don't know how there could not be a more stark example of how little the so-called Republican populists give a fuck about the people that they claim to be fighting for than what's happening right now. I mean, there is absolutely no reason that these people should be dying. There's no reason. And it's not as if they're not interested in taking medicine. It's not as if this is like a Christian Scientist or whatever. They're out there, you know, taking the BoJack Horseman pills. You know, they're out there taking hydroxychloroquine. It's not like hydroxychloroquine is like Advil. You know, it's like it's something they just heard about. But because the elite doctors, you know, the elite liberals, you know, in Washington and New York weren't telling them to take it, then they felt like it was good. It's the populist medicine. And you know, that was one thing when it was kind of an online shtick. And, you know, when the president's going crazy, but when everyone else, you know, before there's a vaccine, before there's an alternative, it was inappropriate there. But now, when there is a medicine that protects people from this almost entirely from death, like with a very, very small percent of exceptions of people who have other underlying medical problems. And yet still people in these communities, the J.D. Vance's whole shtick is that he cares about. His whole shtick is that I care about the hillbillies. I care about the white working class. These elites in the coast don't care about you. The people that he claims to care about are keeling over and dying of a disease that we have a vaccine for because they don't have the balls to say to everybody, actually, guys, Fauci is right on this one. Fauci's right on this one. You don't have to like him. You don't have to like every piece of advice that he gave, but like the vaccine is what is going to protect you. And they won't. They do not say it. Greg Abbott has 3 shots. He went out and got himself a black market booster shot. He got an early drop of that before the album came out. and meanwhile, the conservative talk show hosts in his state are dying. And the conservative grassroots guys who are holding these, you know, anti-mask rallies are dying. And you know, he'll say, yeah, get a vaccine. It'll be kind of like a side point. But then he'll sign an executive order that bans people from mandating vaccines. These guys are charlatans. They're phonies. They're suckering people. And people are dying because of it. And I just, it's pretty astonishing that we've now gone many months of this. And it's, if anything, it's picking up steam.
That's the thing that's interesting about it. Now, again, when I say you wonder what's happening, I mean, you may be thinking, you know, yelling at whatever it is you're listening to us on, saying, well, it's obvious what's happening. But I mean, the fact that these hosts who are so outspoken about it then get the disease and die makes you wonder whether they're doing more than just talking about it, whether there's kind of a strutting arrogance where they have convinced the people around them and, you know, not to do it, as well as then engage in behaviors that, you know, sort of, you know, we're going to walk the walk, which, by the way, I think they probably make a distinction between these guys who died tragically, and we're not taking any pleasure in this whatsoever, no. Because it's
no
terrible,
pleasure. I want them to live.
Terrible loss for their families. They left behind wives and children. But at least they did actually walk the walk, as opposed to the Fox hosts who also cast doubt on the vaccines. But you know, have taken the vaccine. You know that Tucker Carlson's vaccinated. No. You know Laura Ingraham is vaccinated. You know that Fox requires them to inform them of their vaccine status. So the real hypocrisy are these, you know, Fox hosts who, you know, are sneering at the vaccines and the mask mandates when they themselves are vaccinated and live in I'm guessing an antiseptic bubble, protecting themselves from the unwashed people they are misleading.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't any Fox hosts dying, you know. You don't see it, and there's some oldies over there, right? I mean, I guess Tucker's in his middle age still, but you know, there's some old folks over there, and they're not dying. Or the former Fox host Lou Dobbs isn't dying. Like all these people got the shot, and the anthropological side of this is more interesting to me, though it's outside of my expertise. But I cannot fathom why people are just not seeing this anecdotally in their lives and changing behavior. I mean, you're seeing a little bit, right? Like the vaccine rates are going up.
You are seeing it a little bit.
You're not seeing it faster, I guess. I don't. I had a friend who told me recently that in their church, you know, there was a particular couple that was like harassing people that would wear masks and were particularly strong anti-vaxxers. Yeah, obviously. And so, you know where the story's going. Both of them are in the ICU with kids. Oh, and it's just like, I mean, how many times does this story have to happen in different communities all across the country before everybody, you know, before everybody's like, all right, like, let's just count this one as an L here and go ahead and get vaxxed. And, you know, we can go own the libs on something else. But you know, and you are seeing the vaccine numbers go up. So there must be a little bit of that, but some of that I think is due to the mandates that are happening in other states, more than a cultural shift in these communities.
So you mentioned J.D. Vance, who has, you know, continues to play the darkest, most deplorable MAGA cards. You know, it's not just that he's put on the MAGA mask. He now feels that he has to go as, you know, as far as possible. I mean, this is a guy who is this respected author, best-selling author of Hillbilly Elegy. And I mean, he really has become a cartoon character of himself. Stephanie Slade in Reason Magazine has a great piece about his transformation into a hate monger. But his latest tweet, or at least was yesterday, he's subtweeting somebody who said, breaking, the Biden White House proposes lowering the penalty for fentanyl trafficking crimes. By the way, I do not know what the story is there. Okay, just, this is what he's commenting on. And J.D. Vance then tweets, the white working class loved Donald Trump. As punishment, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will kill as many of their children as they can. There's so much going on there. The fact that he's so comfortable with the whole throwing around white and then, you know, name checking Kamala Harris is interesting, and that somehow by lowering the criminal penalties for this, that this means they want people to die, while at the same time J.D. Vance and his fellow MAGA types are continuing to push things that are literally killing children. I mean, you know, that we've been talking about here. And you know the amazing thing about the whole J.D. Vance story?
Is that tweet wasn't even the worst one in the Senate race?
Not even close. And it's not even close. He's running against Josh Mandel, who is the front runner, who is, I wrote about in my newsletter today, he obviously takes his xenophobia raw and his bigotry straight. He put out a tweet, due to radical Muslim refugees, English citizens are afraid to enter Muslim areas of London. French citizens are afraid to enter Muslim areas of Paris. And now Biden wants to make Toledo, Ohio, a hotbed for Afghans? !! We must fight this with all of our might, not in America! !! So he's gone all in anti-Afghan refugees, just playing the whole, I, Donald J. Trump, want a complete and total ban on Muslims. And the reality is, in the Republican Party, he'll pay no price for that. That's the sad thing. That's the tragic thing. That's just the reality, isn't it?
Yeah, he's done a couple follow-ups, too. He talked about Ilhan Omar infiltrating the U.S. government and how the Afghan refugees will infiltrate us, like Ilhan Omar has. He re-upped. Like one of the grossest tweets of the entire last month was from this guy, Steve Cortez, who is a Trump pundit, surrogate on cable news. I think now he has a Newsmax contract or some other like D-list conservative TV outlet. And he tweeted that picture of all of the Afghans in the plane, you know, and talked about how he doesn't want them coming to his neighborhood. This was on August 17th. Yeah. Josh Mandel just decided to quote tweet that this morning.
Today.
You know, 3 weeks later, he's like, you know, this the grossest tweet of August. I want to make sure we carry it into September. You know, he wrote about how these planes are being emptied into Toledo. If the Ohio Senate race didn't exist, like a liberal movie scriptwriter in Hollywood would have to make it up. Honestly, I mean,
I agree.
Like they are a parody of everything that is like that liberals think is the worst about Republicans. Like, and anything that you know you could conjure in your head, that would be a caricature of a bigoted, hackneyed, you know, phony Republican. Josh Mandel and J.D. Vance have that in spades, and it's just what more to even say about this race? I mean, I think that the fact that they think that this is the path, like, you know, explicitly talking about how they only care about the white working class, explicitly talking about, in J.D. Vance's case, about that how Afghan refugees might bomb a mall if they look at your wife the wrong way, if you look at their wife the wrong way, kind of taking the grotesque Trump comments about Khazir Khan and just like turning up the juice a level on them, turning up the bigotry a level. What you just laid out with Mandel, this is just straight into the vein hatred, and that is what they're promoting. And you know, there is no blowback for it.
And there's no stigma.
It was not that long ago that Steve King got run out on a rail. Yeah. And it took a long time. You know, the Republicans didn't deserve any like great medals or points for running him out, but they did. You know, there was some accountability. You see nothing. like the, outside of the Never Trump community, you see no criticism of these guys on the right. Like there is a full embrace.
None.
If anything, other candidates are trying to mimic them and see that as their path to winning primaries. And this is the toilet drain that we're circling in these Republican primaries right now. It's distressing.
Well, I want to get to the Texas abortion law in just a moment, yeah. but this seems to relate to it in some ways that even though they're wallowing in all of this, these are very unpopular opinions. This new ABC poll out this morning, Washington Post poll, shows nearly 7 in 10 Americans, 68%, say they support taking in Afghan refugees after security screening. Only 27% oppose them. This is interesting. Support for the refugees comes from a majority of Republicans. 56% say we should welcome them, 39% who oppose, which is very interesting. So this is not a winning issue. Okay.
Now, just really quick on that.
Yeah.
It's because they're competing for the 39%.
Right.
I mean, and I think that they're misjudging the party a little bit. They probably think it's 50-50. They're competing for the 39. And I think that they're probably right that it's 50-50, that there's maybe about a 10% of the Republican base that is saying that they're for this, like to own Joe Biden kind of, which is like the best kind of owning the libs. If you want to bring in refugees to own Joe Biden, that's just fine with me. Because these folks need community building in this country. But that is the encouraging element about this, is that there is, I think, a real part of the Republican base that wants to do the right thing. Obviously, the Democrats and independents have been in favor of this. And these folks are vetted, right? This is not the Syrian refugee crisis where people are just storming over the border. Like they're stopping in Qatar. They're stopping in Qatar, right? I mean, this is a very controlled process. This is not like what's happening in Europe or the border. The only argument against bringing these Afghans here is pure bigotry and hatred. That's the only argument. While I disagree with some of the arguments that have been put forth about Syrian refugees and asylees at the border, there are some legitimate concerns about, you know, crime and et cetera. If you do not have a vetting system, right? Sure. If you're just overwhelmed, right? Like, you know, that's just the nature of, you know, how rule of law works. That's not what's happening here with Afghanistan. These folks are coming on military planes, stopping and
people, Qatar, right?
I mean, these are the most vetted people in history. If they were secret terrorists, like, you know, they're pretty good at hiding it, seeing that they've been working with our military for the last decade.
So you want a sign of the apocalypse?
Yeah, sure.
I actually agree with the Wall Street Journal editorial this morning.
Whoa.
See, no, that's funny because I used to, like, you know, read them all the time, you know, pre-Trump, and I thought they were pretty reasonable until, you know, Trump broke everybody's mind. But they write about this, the Alabama abortion law. And, Texas, Alabama.
We always smear Alabama on this podcast.
I know, and then we get emails about that. Yeah, but they usually deserve it.
It's the first week in a football season, so it's a good time to smear Alabama. But I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah. Go Miami.
Texas abortion blunder. They say the Supreme Court was right not to interfere for now. Wrong. So I disagree with that. But then it's saying that it's a ridiculous law. So, I mean, here's the two paragraphs. Most laws delegate enforcement to public officials. This one delegates exclusive enforcement to private citizens who are authorized to sue anyone who aids or abets an abortion after 6 weeks. Citizens who prevail in their civil lawsuits are entitled to at least $10,000 per abortion along with legal costs. And then they say, the law sets an awful precedent that conservatives should hate. No kidding. Could California allow private citizens to sue individuals for hate speech, or New York deputize private lawsuits against gun owners? Yeah, why not? See, I think this is one of those, and I'm sorry to use the cliche about the dog that catches the bus. I apologize in advance for all of that. But this strikes me as, if it is going to be a victory for pro-lifers on the Texas law, it is a catastrophic victory. This is the worst possible bill that they could be defending, because you do not have to be pro-choice to look at a law that basically puts bounties on the heads of private citizens and allowing your neighbor, your coworkers, your in-laws, you know, just strangers with a tip line, filing lawsuits against people who might have been involved in an abortion. This whole spying on one another, you know, handing out cash for people, dropping a dime on one another. Look, this is, if Democrats would focus on this, and it's like, for some reason, it's like guys, would you look at this law? This is like the worst law ever. You're going, there's no way that Republican politicians are going to want to defend, you know, having the, you know, was it Mrs. Krebs down the street file a lawsuit against somebody, you know, if, you know, she thinks that they might have driven you to an abortion or something like that. That is not going to play. And as I mentioned earlier, and I can't stress this enough, only 8% of Americans favor a complete ban on abortions with no exceptions whatsoever. So here we are, front and center, a Texas law that says no abortions after 6 weeks, which is in effect a real abortion ban, and no exceptions for rape or incest. Tim Miller, in what world is that going to be a plus for Republicans in the midterm?
I just want to know, out of the depths of whose warped mind do these like bills come from? I mean, Alec is bad enough, but is like they're like an evil Alec, or is there just like one sociopath in the corner there who like comes up with these ideas? Because I remember those, what were those ultrasound, what was the euphemism for the ultrasounds where you would, where that you would literally have to penetrate a woman's vagina to try to get to get remember. The ultrasound that they had to go through before they could get an abortion. Do you remember these and the odds, these bills?
I should.
There was one in Virginia and like normal states that were trying to pass these invasive ultrasound bills, which were, that was kind of what led to the Todd Akin kerfuffle and all that. I mean, it's just a political nightmare, a moral nightmare. And this is, I feel like the, you know, antecedent to that, like what you are seeing in Texas. Everything you said is right. It's just hard to add on top of that how you could like think that a system where a rapist, literally in the system, a rapist could sue. I'm laughing in the macabre sense. Like, you know, could sue to get a bounty for, you know, the for if after 7 weeks their victim had an abortion.
Yeah, right? you can't sue the woman herself. That's important.
Right. They could get a, but I mean, they could get a sue to get a bounty from like the doctor or, you know, who, or, you know, somebody who drove her or like all these sorts of absurd
like ways.
Yeah, there's no exception for rape or incest. And 6 weeks, and then you had the picture. Have you seen the picture from the bill signing? It's all these old white guys with these creepy grins. There are some women there, but it's mostly old white guys with like these creepy grins doing the heart sign with their hands. And it's wonderful. Just like, how did you think? Like when you talked about the liberal bubble earlier.
Yeah,
like, this is at a whole new level.
See, I think
8%. Nobody approves this.
See, this is an interesting point because they're all thinking, "What a great, clever idea this is." And by the way, you can see, you know, why they did it this way because, and this is why the law was not struck down by, it was not put on hold by the Supreme Court, because the state itself does not enforce the law. The law enforcement is completely outsourced to this vigilante litigation system, and they're hoping that the private vigilantes will do it. So that creates a different legal environment, at least technically. So some lawyers cooked this up and said, this is a way to skirt around the courts and Roe versus Wade. Too clever by half. But what it's done is create this absolutely creepy, I know what you did last summer culture in the state of Texas. So have you noticed, by the way, in speaking of other old movies, in the last 24 hours, you haven't seen a lot of football spiking from Republican politicians and Fox News. I don't know. I think it went like 12 hours without even mentioning abortion. I mean, it's like you'd think that they would be thinking this was a pretty cool thing, but no.
You know who hates this more than anyone is Ron DeSantis. He already gets asked about it yesterday, and he's eyeing that 2024 primary and thinking to himself, you know, do I have to do something like this now, right? To not let Greg Abbott or some other lunatic get to the right of me in the 2024 primary in the event that Donald Trump keels over because he's at 67% in the 2024 primary polls, according to Emerson yesterday. So DeSantis... women of Florida should be very deeply concerned at this point, because I think DeSantis is going to feel pressure to do something akin to this. The whole the whole thing is preposterous. It's an absolutely preposterous system. But you know, I mean, the way that the incentive structure of our politics is right now, can we really be certain that it's going to get rolled back? I don't think so. Right. I don't know. If you're the Republicans, despite the fact that there's not a lot of football spiking, you know, there also isn't going to be a lot of blowback in the sort of alternate universe of, you know, the Newsmax media and this, you know, ban at the far right media. In their communities, there's not going to be blowback. You know, we've already seen that they are completely impervious to what's happening in real life, even if people are dying all around them. And so I think that it's a real, you know, serious issue for women in Texas, in addition to kind of the political ramifications.
Well, let's talk about the political ramifications because, you know, earlier on the podcast, we were talking about the passion gap between Republicans and Democrats. And clearly in a midterm election, you want to gin up your base. You want to have some enthusiasm, and Democrats seem not to have had it. Republicans seem to have a lot of things that were motivating them, getting them angry, getting them turned out, kind of quasi 2010 mood. This strikes me as changing the dynamic, because 2 or 3 days ago, we would have, I think, reasonably thought that what happened in Afghanistan would be the determinative issue in the minds of voters. But now, I mean, you've been around politics for a long time. What's likely to have more impact, the abortion issue or Afghanistan, when we're talking about this a year from now?
Yeah, I mean, clearly abortion. Though, for me, Afghanistan is really a stand-in for the competence question. Whether Afghanistan has staying power, I think has less to do with whether people actually care about the fact that we're out of Afghanistan, which they obviously won't, and more about whether Biden, you know, seems like he's got control of the reins here, and that you know, swing voters can feel confident about maintaining unified Democratic control. The abortion bill is obviously, you know, going to have more of an impact in a different set of voters, which is that 19% number that you cited earlier of the very favorable for Biden. Can the abortion bill be used to up the ante on enthusiasm on the left and defray, you know, mm-hmm. some of the natural losses that you have from enthusiasm in a first year midterm, you know, where the other side wants revenge and the other side wants to, you know, you can demagogue against whatever the worst, you know, whatever, you know, bill was passed that their base likes the least, whereas the side in power has complaints about their side in power. And so that's just a natural part of our system. I think the abortion bill could help sort of mitigate some of that.
Oh, I think it's going to fire people up. This is, you know, we keep talking about, you know, culture war issues, and most of those culture war issues, I think, had been cutting in favor of Republicans, at least in terms of motivating people to come out. Well, this is the mother of all culture war issues. This is like the culture war issue. And right now, if Democrats needed something to turn them out, to capitalize on their gains with women voters, this would be the issue. Now, again, I have to just remind people, because a lot of the commentary I think was pretty terrible yesterday on all of this. Number one, the court has not yet overturned Roe versus Wade. This should be very, very clear. They have not ruled on the constitutional issue. There's certainly reason to be very concerned about it. I think the signs are not auspicious for them upholding it, but we have a long way to go before that happens. So it's certainly possible that between now and the midterms, the court could come back and say, okay, we're going to modify Roe and Casey. We're not going to throw them out completely. We're not going to green light this vigilante system. So a lot of things could happen here. So I think this is a huge potential negative for Republicans in the midterms and going ahead. But the Democrats can still blow it, because this is a theme that we need to come back to. If they counter with legislation that guarantees third trimester abortion rights right up until the moment of birth, you know, the kind of thing they were talking about in Virginia at one time, that would not be great. If they decide to take this as a reason to pack the court, that would not be great. You take an issue that puts your opponents in, you know, deep, you know, in a deep moral and political hole, and you let them out by taking an extreme position on the other side. And that both those things are possible.
Yeah, and I just to my point earlier, there is a lot of pressure on Democrats. And it wasn't that long ago that the Democrats had a very heterodox caucus on this issue, right? They had some pro-life people, they had some folks that were safe, legal, and rare. They had some folks that were personally pro-life, but pro-choice, some people who are against late term. It is, the echo chamber makes it very hard for them right now, as I was mentioning earlier, to support anything besides.
Well, look at Joe Biden himself. I mean, yeah, Joe Biden himself had a nuanced position. He's anti-abortion, but was not in favor of bans on abortion, but he also supported the Hyde Amendment. So his position was women should have a right to choose, but we don't use taxpayer money. Yeah. That was kind of that compromise position. And given the fact that the party has moved so far to the left, he was forced to abandon a position he had held for decades and now supports throwing out the Hyde Amendment, which is...
And public opinion, by the way, hasn't shifted like that. It's not like gay marriage, right, where public opinion has shifted to the left. And so, you know, the Democratic politicians followed public opinion. It's not necessarily a right or wrong. And, you know, obviously sometimes politicians should lead public opinion. But it's just an observation about the politics of this. Gay marriage, the public opinion, you know, was the leading indicator. Politicians followed. This is a base politics play where the public opinion on abortion has stayed pretty static. If anything, moved against Democrats a little bit over the past few decades, while they've taken a more extreme position. So that puts them at political risk. I'll say this though: none of that is anywhere near as unpopular as 8%, which is where the no abortions, even in the case of rape and incest, I don't know where bounties on abortions in the case of rape and incest come. That might even get lower than 8%. It's hard to get lower than 8% on anything. So it is a potential for a big political wedge. I can understand the motivation by Democrats to say, okay, well, now we need to codify something. We need to do something to protect this. That makes sense. It's not going to pass the Senate. And so, you know, I think you do have to balance the policy and the politics here. It was in the mid-2010s, or the spate of transvaginal ultrasound bills.
They were killers,
as they well should have been. It was absolutely... And it's one of the most insane sociopathic things that anyone has proposed on any side, that it was going around certain state legislatures and like Pennsylvania and Virginia and other states. And it was just an absolute killer for Republicans. And so in those midterms, so that's something to keep in mind.
Well, I also think, and again, we're sort of, you know, doubling back on this, I hope that people understand that there are people who feel very strongly, very sincerely on this issue. And many of them are very, very conflicted. I was listening to some commentator the other day who said, you know, the pro-life movement was completely concocted. It was completely artificial in order to cover up some racist agenda. And I'm thinking, no, look, the reality is that there are a lot of Americans that actually do believe that we ought to celebrate and cherish life, who actually do believe we're talking about the preservation of human life, and who are not trying to subjugate women. They actually do think that there is a moral component to this. And I do think that there needs to be respect for that position, especially because if you understand that many of those people who do want to celebrate life, and yes, many of them are totally inconsistent, many of them are completely hypocritical when it comes to the death penalty or what happens after a child is born. These are some of the same people who, you know, applauded, you know, the separation of families at the border and stuff. And this is a real failure of much of the pro-life movement. But there are people of goodwill who are pro-life, who are going to look at this bill and say, no, this is terrible. I do not want people spying on one another. I do not want bounties on vigilante litigation that is going to harass people involved in all of this. That is not the way that you change the culture. That's not the way you change people's hearts and minds. That's not the way you reach young women who are making the decisions to do all of this. See, and that's I think the part of the tragedy of all of this is that pro-lifers ought to be focused on the culture of life as opposed to getting these draconian, cheap, own the libs wins. Because even though they may have short-term wins, in the long run, I think they're doing themselves immeasurable harm.
This is really, I just want to add to this because I got, you know, sort of waylaid dealing with the attacks on this, but it is true. Like this is a true point. And I think that for people who, you know, have had very deep seated conversions on this issue, or you know, even you know those who've had this from their young, people who have had this personal experience. Women, Sarah Quinlan wrote about this beautifully for us in the Bulwark last year. You know, who've looked at ultrasounds, their own ultrasounds, their wives, their sisters, their friends, and felt that connection. Felt like that is a human. Like this is a human, and we need to protect this vulnerable human life. For people that feel that sincerely. Of which I count myself among them, like this bill is a nightmare for them.
Yes.
Too, right? Like it's exactly. A nightmare for women, obviously, and like the women who are going to have to suffer directly from this are obviously the number one people who will be victimized by this bill. But for anyone that wants to persuade folks to that point of view, that this is something as a society we should value, this bill is doing very serious harm to that. And I completely agree with that. And I think that's an important point.
Well, and that was one of the debates that we had during the Trump era where many pro-lifers who said, okay, I'm going to swallow everything else. But if I get a Supreme Court justice who's pro-life, I'm willing to put up with everything else Donald Trump does. The counter argument to that was you have lashed yourself to all of this other stuff in the long run. Does that, I mean, again, don't think of the next 4 years, think of the next 30, 40 years. Think about, you know, the cultural impact of making, of putting the pro-life movement in bed with Trumpism, with all that other baggage and everything. Is that really what you want to do? Does that really create a culture of respect for life? Because ultimately, whatever happens, it is going to come down to individuals' choices and their values and their sense of, you know, of who they are. And all of that plays together. And I think this is one of the mistakes that the pro-life movement has made is they became excessively legalistic. And just a little background, because people might know, you know, I consider myself pro-life and I raised money for many years for pro-life movements. And the thing that was the most effective thing that we were doing or that I was involved in was, you know, putting these ads on television that were not hectoring, were not threatening, were not calling for legislation. They were basically trying to convince young women, hey, you know what? If you choose life, you're not going to be alone. And here's and the stories of you, and basically they feature these young women talking about the choice they made, the dilemmas they made, you know, the challenges and why they made the choice. And that kind of hearts and minds campaign was moving the needle. It was changing people's decision. And pro-choicers should not object to this because this was about, yes, you have the choice and we're hoping you make this choice as opposed to that choice. That's the way it should be. And now I think what's happened is it's devolved into we have to go along with Trumpism. We have to go along with these laws. We are spying on you. We're looking at you. We want to punish you. We want to ban this. We want to make it impossible. And I just think that's a fundamental betrayal of what ought to be the underlying values and strategy of this movement.
I just want to add one last thing on this. There was a meme going around from Occupy Democrats yesterday. It says, if the fetus is a person at 6 weeks, is that when child support starts? Is that when also you can't deport the mother because she's carrying a U.S. citizen? Can I insure a six-week fetus and collect if I miscarry? A good troll. But also, I looked at that and kind of thought,
yeah,
if an actual pro-life movement would say yes to that, all the things. And there were actually, to their credit, some pro-lifers who replied to them saying, yes, I support this. Now, that's very separate from the Republican Party. No Republicans, you know, can you imagine what Josh Mandel would say about, you know, calling a six-week, fetus an American citizen already? You know, you can already see what would be happening on the right there. But just in this imaginary world that you're talking about, which is how do you persuade, how do you bring people over to that side? If you're of that perspective, to me, I look at that and say, yeah, that would be a much more persuasive. I 6 weeks is kind of, you know, has its own problems, but just as a general statement, you know, a bill that does that protects, you know, that helps women who are dealing with pregnancies by, you know, giving them the benefits of that of that child earlier, like that would be something that could, you know, everybody's not going to be for that, obviously, but you're going to, that is drawing more people in, right? Because it is about this broader culture of how can we support, you know, a culture of life, not just the child, but the mother who oftentimes is going through a really challenging situation. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't be, you know, considering an abortion.
Tim Miller.
I want to do one other thing really quick.
Sure, please,
it's your Tim Miller voice. I'm going down to see the Tigers this weekend. I'm going to enjoy myself. But I would be very remiss if I did not mention, amidst me enjoying myself in Los Angeles, there are many people in actual Louisiana who are not going to enjoy their weekend very much. You know, with the cable moves on from these sorts of things, right? You have your dramatic picture and the winds, and Al Roker is, you know, the winds are blowing. Al Roker, I thought he was too old to do this sort of thing anymore. I felt like he kind of had gained enough credibility to not be the guy, but he's still the guy and the winds are blowing. And then a few days later, you know, you move on and Texas abortion bill and Afghanistan and whatever else comes up, economic numbers. But there's still no power in New Orleans right now. You know, they did a wonderful job securing the levees after Katrina. So we're not totally incapable of doing anything right. But the Entergy, which is the company, the electric company down there, had an absolute catastrophe. Supposedly they're supposed to have a backup plan for a situation like this. The backup plan has failed. If you are somebody that is particularly low income, you don't have an option to leave town in New Orleans. You've now been stuck in 90 degree heat, humid in the summer, no air conditioning. If you didn't have water backup, it's been hard to go get water. There's obviously a lot of other downstream negative consequences when you don't have electricity. I just want to kind of acknowledge that is a very real problem that people need to be looking at, that the impact of, you know, these sorts of big climate events is not just like what happens on day one. And, if folks can support efforts to help that recovery, that's still something that is going to be an ongoing problem for a while now.
It is going to be, as well as the Northeast, which has also been stunning, and the stunning death toll. Tim Miller, enjoy your trip to Los Angeles and your long holiday weekend. I'm going to be taking a few days off. I'm going to be out east. Amanda Carpenter will be sitting in for me on Tuesday and Wednesday, and I will be back here on Thursday. And I'll be talking with Bill Kristol on Thursday. So just hang on.
I'll be listening now that I know that it's Amanda.
Well, Amanda's going to be sitting in for a couple of days. And of course, next week is going to be the run-up to the September 11th, 20th anniversary. And whoa. So just when you think things are going to calm down, you know, they won't. Because they never do. Tim, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
See you, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. We will be back next Tuesday. Amanda Carpenter, I will be back next Thursday.